Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Joshua Pommettier. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. My name is Edward Willett, and I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. My main publisher is Daw Books in New York, which is also the main publisher of my guest this episode, Joshua Pommettier. I also have my own little publishing company called Shadowpaw Press, and my latest thing is actually from Shadowpaw Press. It's a young adult science fiction novel called Star Song, which I'm very fond of. It almost was published by a major publisher back in the early 90s, very early in my career, and it didn't happen. The publisher died and decided, the new publisher, the son of the original publisher, decided they weren't going to publish science fiction anymore. And so as a result, it languished. It never found a home. And when I went back to it recently, I realized I could make it better. So I completely rewrote it from start to finish, and it is now available from Shadowpaw Press. Again, that's called Star Song, and it's a young adult science fiction novel, very much in the Andre Norton, Robert A. Heinlein mode, who were huge influences on me as a young reader and a beginning writer. So that's my latest thing. Before that, my latest book from Daw Books is The Moonlit World, which is book 3 in my World Shaper series. The first book is World Shaper, the second book is Master of the World, and then The Moonlit World is the third book. There'll be a fourth book. I haven't written it yet, and it will probably also be coming out from Shadowpaw Press. But that's... It's an interesting series, I think, because it's set in a labyrinth of shaped worlds where the people who shape those worlds live inside them, rather like authors living inside their books. So it allows for any kind of story to be told. So I've had a story that's set in a version of our world was the first book. The second book was in a world very much inspired by Jules Verne. So, you know, weird airships and submarines and things, kind of steampunk. And then The Moonlit World, the most recent one, is actually set in a world with werewolves and vampires and peasants. Werewolves and vampires and peasants. Oh my. So you might want to check those out. Now, arising out of this podcast has been an anthology called Shapers of Worlds. I kickstarted that last year, and it features the first-year guests of the podcast. There were 9 original stories and 9 reprints from people like Shauna McGuire and Tanya Huff and David Weber and John Scalzi and many, many other well-known famous authors. That worked so well that I've kickstarted a new one, Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. It's getting very close now. I think it will be out in October. It's bigger. It's going to be pushing 150,000 words of fiction, and it's going to feature new stories from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Heldy Kennedy, Lisa Kester, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Zoll, and me, and reprints from Jeffrey A. Carver, Barbara Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S.M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. So among those authors, you've got winners and nominees for every major science fiction and fantasy literary award and several international bestsellers. So that's coming out in October. Keep an eye out for that. It's called, again, Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. It will be out from Shadowpaw Press. You can find Shadowpaw Press books anywhere, or you can order them directly from the website, shadowpawpress.com, and download the ebooks directly from shadowpawpress.com as well. All right, well, I think that kind of covers the beginning material for this episode of the podcast. Introduction was the word I was looking for. So let's get on to this episode's guest, Joshua Pommettier. Oh, I should first remind you, though, that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Now let's get on to this episode's guest, Joshua Pommettier. A professor of mathematics at the State University of New York in Oneonta, Joshua Pommettier has published 9 novels, the Throne of Amancor series, the Skewed Throne, the Cracked Throne, and the Vacant Throne, with Daw Books, a publisher I know well, the Well of Sorrows series, Well of Sorrows, Leaves of Flame, Breath of Heaven, with Bane and Zombies Need Brains, and the Lay series, Shattering the Lay, Threading the Needle, and Reaping the Aurora with Daw, which is the one we're going to talk about today specifically. He's currently at work on the start of a new series. He's also published numerous short stories, Mastahuba and Close Encounters of the Urban Kind in Tears of Blood and Beauty Has Her Way, both edited by Jennifer Brozek, The River in River, edited by Alma Alexander, and Daughter of the Sands and Apollo's Daughters, edited by Brian Young. So, Joshua, welcome to the World Shapers.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Now, we've known each other for a while now because of the DAW connection, since we share a publisher and an editor. And I remember a memorable escape room adventure in Kansas City where we've, you know, if you've ever wondered how many professional science fiction and fantasy authors it takes to get out of an escape room, more than you have, apparently, because we did not do all that well.
We didn't even come close.
It's where you think you haven't done too bad, and then you find out there's a whole other room that you didn't even get into. That's always discouraging. But it was fun anyway.
Yeah, it was all about having fun.
Yeah. So we will start where I always start, by taking you back into the mists of time and find out you had a moving around childhood. I know that. But anyway, where you grew up, how you grew up, and how you got interested in writing, and probably you started as a reader, most of us do. And yeah, so tell me all that. Tell me your life story.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm in upstate central Pennsylvania, and my dad was in the Navy, though, so we ended up moving around quite a bit. So I've lived like Florida, Texas, Washington State, California, Virginia, lots of different places. I think that actually helps with the fantasy writing, because you get that exposure to so many different kinds of places and settings and cultures and all that stuff. But yeah, I spent most of, I spent the longest amount of time in Washington State, out in Puget Sound. And that's actually where the whole thing started. I was in, obviously I got into writing through reading, like you said earlier, but it wasn't until eighth grade English class with Mrs. Eloff that I actually started thinking about writing. She gave us a writing assignment that was unusual for English classes. She said she wanted us to write, you know, a 500-word short story that was kind of Twilight Zone-ish. And, you know, English, they usually focus in on, like, you know, the three-paragraph essays or something like that. Mm-hmm. And this was, like, brand new. It was, like, actually what I consider creative writing. And so I like dove into this because it was Twilight Zone. And by then I was reading a lot of fantasy and science fiction. And this horrible ripoff of Atlantis, except I had spaceships. So you know, and at that time I was like, 500 words, I don't know if I can pull out 500. It's going to be hard. So I ended up writing this and handed it in, and she sent it back with, you know, a little note on the top saying, you should write more. And that was like a bulb moment for me. I actually sat back and was like, oh, wait, all of these books that I'm reading and that I love, you know, they're, you know, being written by somebody. And so I was like, why couldn't that be me? And but that was the spark. I sat down and I started writing pretty much immediately after that.
It's funny how often it's funny how often I talk to authors and they say they had that realization at some point. Hey, people actually write these things. I could be one of those people. It seems to be a very common thing.
When that happens, you're just like, well, duh, of course people write these things. But it just, for some reason, doesn't make that connection until somebody points it out. And that was my little epiphany when it comes to writing. And I started writing things for, like, at the time, Gary Norton had the Magic and Iskar anthology she was doing. And so I like wrote a short story for that. And I actually sent that in back in the whole paper envelope time. And typewriter time too. I used up so much corrective tape on my typewriter.
Liquid paper. Remember liquid paper?
And liquid paper, yeah. I use the corrective tape mostly, but yeah, the liquid paper came into it, yep. And then I started, of course, the standard, you know, all of my friends in school get transported to an alternate world kind of story. And that one was supposed to be a novel. I actually had a whole orange folder I was using, and I was writing it out by hand and putting it in the orange folder. And oh, it's all so exciting. And I'm sure if I had that at this point, I would get in horror. But you know, at the time, it's like, oh, it was very exciting to be actually writing this stuff. And so, I mean, I kept writing on stuff all through high school and whatnot. Then when I hit college, you know, along the way, I told my mom, you know, I want to be a writer and a fantasy writer and all this. And she was like, she was very encouraging and said, yeah, that's really good. You know, you need to have something to fall back on if that doesn't work out. And so I decided early on that I was going to be a math teacher, and then I could write during the summer, and so I'd have a lot of time to write. And so that was my plan. I went to college to become a math professor, and then in college, at some point, I actually sat back, said to myself, okay, are you writing just for kicks, you know, just for you and your friends and whatnot, or do you really seriously want to pursue this? And I made the decision to obviously seriously pursue it. and I spent the first 4 years of college, you know, writing this novel, it was called Sorrow. And it went through, I mean, I went through the whole first draft, and when I hit the end of that first draft, I went back to the beginning and I was like, holy crap, this sucks. Because draft, I was teaching myself how to write. And so of course the beginning was horrible. So I ended up revising this like 3-4 times before I started sending it out to agents and editors and stuff. Amazingly, at the time, I didn't realize this, but I was actually getting from agents and editors, I was actually getting personal responses to the manuscript. And, you know, only later did I learn that, you know, that was like a couple levels up on the rejection list. Mm-hmm. So they were rejections, but they were personal rejections.
Although that only goes so far, where you say, yeah, well, it was a personal rejection, but it was still a rejection.
It was still a rejection, yeah. And of course, I didn't know any better that, you know, that this was, you know, a better rejection than you could have gotten. So I kept at it. And, you know, eventually, 4 books in, I ended up writing The Skewed Throne and sent that to Daw. But by then, Daw was kind of already paying attention to me. They'd seen 2 or 3 of my books and, you know, rejected them. But Sheila was kind of paying attention to me at that. And so when I sent in Skewed Throne, she was excited about Skewed Throne. So that's essentially how I ended up getting into it.
You obviously liked math, or you wouldn't have made that as your fallback position. When did you?
I don't know. I wouldn't know. I don't know if I would say that I, you know, am in love with math, but I love teaching math. So I might be a college professor, but I'm pretty hardcore teacher as opposed to, you know, researcher. Even though I work at a college, so I think it's more the love of teaching. Because I mean, if I made it really, really big, I'd probably have to give up teaching, but I can't imagine giving up teaching, you know, just because I enjoy it too much.
What do you enjoy about teaching? And does it relate to what you enjoy about writing? Because they're both about communication.
Yeah, I don't know if it has much to do. I don't know. I've never thought about it with writing, but, what I love about is when you see that spark in the student, when things finally connect and they suddenly understand something that they thought was, you know, exceptionally hard. Because I'm teaching things like calculus and higher level math above calculus and stuff. And most people think that calculus is this horrendously difficult subject. So one of my goals in teaching is to try to make people realize that it's not really as complicated as they think it is. The idea behind it is actually very simple. And so when I teach, I try to get that across. And seeing that understanding when they finally get it, that's the best part of teaching. And so I don't know how that relates to writing, because the problem with writing is that I'm not there to see people reacting to it, like I am with teaching. And that was one of the hardest things with this past year when we had all of the online teaching, is that I wasn't getting that interaction with the students with the online teaching and not like in the classroom. And so that was kind of hard.
Yeah, I had my daughter's university age, University of Toronto, and she was entirely online. And certainly on the student side of it, it's not great either.
I can't imagine.
That lack of personal.
I mean, learning math online, that's horrible. That's got to be horrible.
She's kinesiology, and she was helping first-year students. They're learning anatomy online. And one of the things about the University of Toronto is that it's one of the few places where first-year kinesiology students have access to cadavers for learning anatomy. And, of course, this last year's crop of students didn't have that. So, yeah, it was certainly not ideal, that's for sure.
No. Math online is not ideal.
We just going back to when you were talking about writing, I had forgotten until you were talking about writing as a young person that we, in fact, were on, maybe the first time I met you, in fact, was at the Denver World Science Fiction Convention, and we were on a panel together, writers reading their juvenilia. Do you remember that?
I do. I actually proposed that panel.
I thought I proposed that panel. Maybe we both proposed it.
Yeah, it might have been a dual proposal, yeah.
So it was you and me and Sarah Hoyt and Connie Willis, as I recall, and it went over really well. But I don't remember you reading anything from when you were really young. Do you have, has all of that gone missing?
That's
since,
pretty much.
Since those
yeah,
years?
It most of it got lost during a flood. We had, here in Binghamton, we had two major floods. And 2006 and 2011, I think we had a flood, and I lost three of my stuff in the first flood, and a lot of it was paperwork kind of stuff like that. So anything that I had that I was keeping, including, you know, my multitudinous rings, all of that kind of stuff, paperwork got lost during the flood. So at the time, I didn't have anything really old, like the juvenile, that story that was in the orange notebook and stuff. That's what I would have read if I'd had a chance. But yeah, so on that panel, I ended up just talking about the things that I'd written.
Yeah, I think I have my old stuff. In fact, my first novel is right here on my desk, and it says algebra on it, but it's actually just what the notebook was, full of doodles of people in armor and 201 handwritten pages, my first novel.
Although, I don't even know how many pages I ended up with that first book.
Considering how
my
writing is, it was not novel length. It was probably maybe 30,000 words, maybe tops, I would think, looking at it now. But it seemed like a lot of words to me at the time.
Oh, yeah. Like that 500. I thought writing 500 words for a short story was, like, insane.
Well, we're going to talk about your process of writing novels now that you've, you know, you learned how to do it eventually and started getting published. And we're going to talk about the Lay series. So maybe the first thing to do, I mean, it's a trilogy. Is it complete?
Lay series. that trilogy is finished. Like all three of the trilogies that I have out right now, they're all set in the same world, but they're at different time periods. And you know, closely enough, you can see where things connect up between the three series.
Well, give us an overview of the world in the series, then, without giving away anything you don't want to give away. After all, you have you've taught classes on or taught writers about writing synopses, so this ought to be easy for you.
Yeah, no, synopses are never easy, especially ones where you give anything away. So I'll focus on the Lay series. But the idea behind the Lay series was the spark of the idea was that I kept reading all of these fantasy novels, and in most of the fantasy novels, there was always some kind of like apocalyptic event that happened in the past, and that was part of what had shaped the world into what it was. And I even had that. I had that in my Thrones series. And so I was like, you know, why does nobody ever write about the apocalyptic event? Because I'm a huge, huge fan of apocalyptic stories and novels. And so I was like, why in fantasy worlds is it always something that happened in the past? And so I said, I'm going to write something that's an apocalyptic. And, you know, and I already had the world set up from the Throne series. And so I more or less in my head kind of knew what the apocalypse was. So that unfortunately is not enough to actually write a book. You always need, you know, your characters. So the way I think of it is that was the idea. Idea for even a short story is not enough. You have to have, you know, a strong story behind the idea. And that usually involves a character. And I didn't have a character at the time and just filed it away as a potential idea. And then Kara showed up. And once Kara showed up, I was like, okay, the world is going to be off of the ley lines, those magical lines that connect stone monuments like Stonehenge and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I said, so I also, Kara, and she's going to be able to manipulate the ley. So there's my character. And I knew, of course, that there was going to be an apocalypse. And then I kind of said, that's quite enough, because you need your fantasy world or your fantasy to have something that's kind of different and unique about it. So I was waiting to figure out what the uniqueness might be. And the uniqueness ended up being not the ley lines, because, I mean, ley lines have been used forever. The uniqueness ended up being the time period. I was like, I want to be a fantasy, but I want it to have a very, very modern feel to it. So I wanted it to feel like, you know, New York or London, maybe not right now, but, you know, maybe 100 years ago or 200 years ago or something like that. So I wanted the society to be using the ley lines, but I wanted them to be using the power of the ley lines like we use electricity. So I have like, I was like, okay, the world's going to have like a subway, and, you know, we're going to use the ley for lighting and heating, and, you know, basically everything we use electricity for, they were going to use the ley lines for. And so that once I had that, it felt like I had a sort of well-rounded world. And at that point, I was like, okay, let's see what this feels like if I start writing it. Because I'm a pantser. I don't really plot synopses, and I don't really write outlines, and I don't plan out the chapters or anything like that. I pretty much just say, aha, there's my character. So I had Kara. And then I just sat down and started writing. I was like, okay, she manipulates the ley. Let's start with her you know, going out to manipulate the lei somehow. And that's how I got on the whole lei series. Obviously, I know, even though I'm a pantser, I know a little bit about what's supposed to be happening. Like, for example, for the lei series, I knew we were headed to apocalypse. And I kind of had, you know, a rough idea of some, like, goalposts along the way. But that's, when I sit down, that's usually all I have. And I've learned to trust myself that my brain, my hind brain, will figure out what's supposed to happen and will make it happen the way it should. I fought it with a couple levels earlier on, and then I just gave up and said, you know, I just got to trust myself and just write. And so that's pretty much what I do now, is just sit down and start writing. Doing that with the third book in the series I'm writing right now, which I just started like last week. I have no clue where it's going, but I'm going to trust that it's going to work itself out. And I have to say that with the lace, I was incredibly impressed with my hind brain, especially with book three in that series, Reaping the Aurora. The groundwork was laid, obviously, in book one and book two, but the way that all of the little plot lines, because I ended up with essentially three major characters, the way that the plot line, three major characters ended up coming together in the end of the third book, I was personally stunned. And it all fell into place. I realized what was going to happen in book three, having a breakfast at a convention with Sheila Gilbert. She, you know, we were just chatting about things and whatnot, and I can't remember if it was something she said or some she asked, and I was starting to answer it, and all of a sudden it just hit me, you know, what was going to happen in the third book, and it like fell in my lap, complete and whole, and I literally like gasped and was like. Like she had no idea what was going on, but I was just like, holy crap, that it's all gonna fit and it's all gonna work out, and I can't believe, I literally, when I finished the book, I was just like, I can't believe I wrote that. The way it all worked out, it was stunning.
Yeah, it's amazing what goes on somewhere back in your brain that you're not actually aware of it, and then it presents itself sometimes as you're writing, and it's like, oh yeah. I've kind of had a similar experience, so yeah, I do know what that feels like.
It's in math too. I think that's why my math and writing go so well together, is because to get your degree in math, you have to prove something that's never been proven before in math, and so there's a lot of stress involved there, because you're not guaranteed to prove it when you set out, but there's a lot of, I think this is true, and you work on it, and then one night you wake up in the morning and you're just like, oh, let's try this, and it's like your hindbrain has figured out while you were sleeping how to solve that problem. It's amazing.
So since you're a pantser, do you start off with any kind of written notes to yourself about the character or the world or anything, or is it you just think about it and then you start writing and then it comes together?
It's the latter, pretty much. I don't usually write any notes. In fact, people would probably be shocked at how few notes I have even after I finish the book. But I don't start with any, in general, I don't start with any outline, anything. I usually just sit down and start writing. And then I have a notebook that I keep beside the computer, but the notebook is mainly for things like, you know, when I introduce a new character, I say they have blue eyes and, you know, gray hair, then I write in the little notebook, you know, blue eyes, gray hair. There's not really too many plot elements or anything that go in the notebook, but the notebook is more for continuity kind of things. And as I write, like if I'm writing, like right now, I'm writing chapter 2 in the new book. And as I write, if I have an inkling of what I think is going to happen in the next chapter, I will, at the end of the current chapter, I will put in brackets a little note about what I think is going to happen. And the note is usually only about what's going to happen, like, next. I rarely have a note that's like, you know, something that's going to happen 10 chapters from now. Those kind of notes I keep in my head because things change as I write. And they usually change so dramatically that there's no point in me writing the note down. Because by the time I get there, it's going to be complete. So I usually keep my notes to what's happening next. And then, you know, about halfway through the book, I've got quite a few little notes because I usually have quite a few character plot lines going on. Near the end of the book, those notes start disappearing because you've written them. So that's more or less the extent of any notes that I write. The only exception is the plot synopsis that I sometimes have to write in order to sell a trilogy. Mm-hmm. So if Sheila's interested in something, then of course, usually wants to buy a trilogy. She doesn't want to buy just one book. So at that point, you know, she wants to know what's going to happen in book 2 and what's going to happen in book 3. And so at that point, I have to find something in order to sell the trilogy. And so I do for that type of situation, I will write down, you know, sort of a mini plot synopsis of what I think is going to happen. But Sheila learned early on that, you know, she has to take any of these plot synopses that I write with a lump of salt because it changes dramatically, like I said, as I write.
I was going to ask you that, if you actually worry about it, what's in the synopsis as you get there.
No, I mean, I will try to forewarn Sheila if it looks like it's going to be dramatically different. So, you know, I'm sending Sheila notes quite often saying, by the way, this is not going to happen anymore. but the good news is, you know, usually the end result is much more interesting and much more creative than it is that I wrote down, you know, 2 years ago when the series started. Because, you know, the characters take control and they do things you weren't planning. And during those 2 years, you know, it's not like I'm not thinking about the story or anything. I'm still thinking about the story and new ideas crop up as I'm writing. And so, you know, those new ideas are generally far cooler than whatever the initial idea was.
What does your actual writing process look like? I mean, you're a full-time teacher. How do you find time to write? When do you fit it in? And are you a fast writer or a slow writer?
Oh, I would rate myself a pretty slow writer. You know, if I get 1,000 words in a day, happy. and that's like low for most writers that I talk to. But yeah, it is somewhat of a challenge, getting the writing in while teaching is going. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to do college, teach at a college, is because you can kind of create your own schedule. So what I do at SUNY Oneonta is schedule all of my teaching in the morning. So usually I'm done with teaching, done with office hours, all of that kind of stuff, usually around noon or 1. And then I have a commute home. It takes me about an hour one way for the commute. And so I'm usually getting home, you know, like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock or whatever. And then the afternoon is supposed to be writing. And unfortunately, doesn't necessarily mean writing. sometimes writing means, you know, doing your taxes or, you know,
yeah.
things related to writing, like promotion, doing an interview, you know, answering interview questions by email or, you know, all of the business side of writing usually gets done during that time as well. But most of the time, I have a couple hours to sit down and write. And so that's what I do. I get home, I sit down at the computer, and I try to get to writing as soon as I can and try to get in at least a couple hours. And like I said, I'm shooting for 1,000 words per day in that couple hours. And the commute is actually useful because the hour commute gives me a chance to kind of switch from my math brain to my writing brain. So I'm kind of core dumping all of the math on the drive home and whatever it is I need to write that day. And so, you know, it gives me a chance to think about it before I actually sit down and write. So it that helps with the, you know, sitting down and just staring at a blank page for that doesn't usually happen because I'm usually like, okay, here's where I left off and this is where I need to pick up and start. And I get all of that done while I'm driving.
Yeah. I find driving a great way to think about writing. I've come up with entire new books, driving places and thinking about it on the way. Walking too, except I'm currently live streaming my walks, which means I talk for the entire time I'm walking. So walking right now is not helping me with my writing, but the driving is great for that.
Yes, I've seen your walking videos, walking around the city.
Yeah, it's fun. 130 some straight I've done now, 130 some days straight. I haven't missed one, which is quite amazing to me and the three people that watch. What does your revision process look like? Once you have a draft then, how do you go about polishing it up before submission? Do you use beta readers too, or all that stuff?
Well, I have a critique group where I run my short stories through. And most of the time, I'm not running the novels through the critique group. I mean, I did the series that just sold to DAW that should start coming out next year. That one I ran the entire first book through the critique group because I was writing that one before it was sold. So getting feedback on all the way through. But in general, for my novels, I don't have a critique group looking at it or reading it. And the critique group hasn't seen book two or book three for that series yet because it's sold. But what I do for revisions is while I'm writing, if there's something that I feel like I need to change, I make a little note in a file. And I don't change it. Like, you know, if I'm on chapter six and all of a sudden I think, oh, you know, if I'm going to do this in chapter six, then I have to change this that happened in chapter three. I never go back and actually revise it at that point. I just say, okay, a note about it. This is what you need to change and why. And then I just leave it and I keep writing. And in my head, I'm basically just pretending that I wrote it that way the first time. And I just write until I get the first one. I mean, lots of people tell me that they go back and revise as they're writing, and I can't do that. I learned not to do that on one of my novels because by the time I got to the end of that novel, I finally knew what the book was really about. And so all of the revisions I'd made along the way were useless because now I understood exactly what the book was supposed to be about. And so I had to go back to everything I'd already changed to fit that new understanding of the book. And so I learned with that book that it's better to just jot down some notes and see when you reach the end exactly what the book's supposed to be about. And so that's what I do now. I wait till the end. And once I understand exactly where the book is going and what's going to happen and what it all means to the characters. Then I go back and look at all my revision notes and do a pass where I just usually revise only what's happened or only what I have in my revisions. And what I found is usually I only end up changing about half of the things that were in my notes. Like the book that I just finished and handed in to Sheila, I probably had a page of notes. So there's maybe, 10, 12 notes. And then when I went back and read those sections over again that I thought I had to change, I was like, no, actually, this actually works well the way it is. And so I ended up not changing like half of the things that I jotted down. I just decided they were, that the change was unnecessary. Like I said, that was a hard lesson with the one novel. So then I do a revision. And at this point, that revision, based off of my notes, and if it happens to have gone through a critique group, the notes from the critique group, I make changes, and then I send it to my agent. And my agent usually has suggestions for changes. I was really shocked with this most recent book. He had two suggestions, but they weren't really changes. They were just like, think about this kind of things. But he usually has things he would like me to change, especially if we haven't sold the book yet. And so usually I do another revision pass for the agent, two revision passes for the agent, and then after that, it's whatever the editor just, whoever buys it. At that point, they get their say.
And what is the editing? I know how Sheila works, but let's tell people. What is it like working with Sheila? What sort of things come back to you from her that you then have to work on in the revision pass, the editorial pass?
The Sheila usually wants more.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to know, and it's almost always world building stuff. She wants to know more about the world, more about how the magic works. I don't generally get any kind of like character comments from Sheila. It's usually just, here's the scene, and you mentioned this, but you don't really go into a lot of detail here. And she's like, I want to know a little bit how this part of the magic works. Or I want to know, I usually have fairly large worlds, and they're usually mixing in a city. And she usually wants me to include, can you bring in more mentions of, people from different parts of the world that happen to be mingling in the city? And, so you're getting in more hints about the world and how big it is and how many various people are there and kind of thing. Because my books tend to focus very closely on one or two characters. In fact, the Throne series is entirely first person. And so, you're following one character through the whole trilogy. The more recent ones, like the Lay series, I usually follow, like I said, like with two or three characters pretty closely. And so it's the because of that point of view, you're pretty restricted on what you see of the world. You're pretty much only seeing what that character sees.
Mm-hmm.
So Sheila's edits are usually, have her notice more. and try to fit in. She always wants me to fit in more about the world without, of course, info dumping, which is hard to do, because if you're deep inside a character's head, the different characters notice different things, and so it's hard to bring in a lot of especially world stuff, because to that character, that world building stuff is automatic. Like, they don't think about it, because to them, it's their world. They're living there. That's an everyday thing to them. But it's not really in some sense, it's not really registering on their consciousness.
It's like the fish. Fish doesn't notice the water.
Yeah, exactly. And so inserting interesting elements of the world through that point of view without it being obvious that, you know, I am the author, I'm trying to tell you this, to make it fit in with that character's perspective, that's hard.
Yeah, that's one of those.
And that's why I think a lot of people say that something is an info dump when it's not really an info dump. What's happened is that you've been inside this character and then you've stepped outside of that character to give across this information, and then you go back into the character, and the reader is recognizing that you have stepped out of the character's head for a moment, and that's when, you know, group usually says, oh, this is an info dump. And when I go back and look at it, I was like, no, it's not really an info dump. It's just, that's not something the character would really notice. So it sticks out.
It's partly the challenge of the different viewpoints. I mean, first person viewpoint is even worse when it comes to trying to get the information out to the reader.
I agree. First person's really hard to do well.
In fact, my last few books, I have a first person character, but I mix it with third person characters, so I have multiple viewpoints, but only one of them is first person. I've now done that for 4 books, and one reason for that is that it's an opportunity to get some information about the world out in a different way than if you're stuck in that one person's head, who obviously is not going to notice everything that you perhaps want the reader to know about.
Yes, and doing what you're doing, I think, is even harder than just writing first person for the whole thing, because you know, first person for the whole thing, once you get in their head, you're good to go. You know, once you've got their voice and their patter down and all that kind of stuff, you're good to go. But then if you're starting to mix in these other point of views, it on the writer, it becomes very difficult, because you've got one distinct voice that's first person, but then when you skip to the third person, you know, you've got to get yourself out of that voice.
Yeah,
and into this third person voice.
I have noticed
and
that. Yeah.
that's extremely tough. I mean, and then there's been some writers that have said they've written multiple points of view, first person for all of them. I think that's even worse.
I actually tried that, and I found that was not working for me at all in this particular book that I'm working on right now. And it was just almost impossible to keep the two voices different. When they're both really me in a way. So anyway.
Yeah, that's why I think that's so hard.
It's all,
you gotta have distinct voices for each first person character, and I haven't even tried it. I can't even imagine trying it.
And I always tell people when I'm talking about writing that we're all trying to solve the same problems, and there's lots of different ways to approach these problems of getting information out to the reader and everything, and we're all trying to find the best balance in whatever it is that we're writing. So it's interesting, and that's what this whole podcast is about, of course, is all the what's that thing from Kipling? There are 12 and 20 ways of constructing tribal lays or something like that. There's a lot of different
ways. I don't
know
if I've heard that.
I think it's Kipling. I'd have to look it up again. Alrighty, well, there's another thing I wanted to ask you about. We've talked about your writing process, and it's now gone to the editor, and of course it's published, and you make a billion dollars, and everybody's happy. We'll just assume that. But you've also done something different in that you have your own publishing company now, Zombies Need Brains, LLC. And tell me how that all came about. I'm familiar with it because I've written a couple of short stories for recent anthologies, and I also drew on your expertise in the kickstarting world when I kickstarted the anthologies connected to this podcast. So how did Zombies Need Brains? Well, tell us about it, and how did it come about?
Zombies Need Brains is just a little small press that I founded, and basically, we like to publish science fiction and fantasy themed anthologies. And as you mentioned, we fund all of these things through Kickstarters. And thankfully, pretty much all of the ones we've attempted to fund have funded. And the way it came about was was actually a group signing at a Barnes & Noble, and the signing went horribly. Like power went out. I mean, it was just a horrible group signing. And so as typical after a signing like this, we all decided to go to the bar. So after the signing, we went to the bar, and we were all, you know, laughing and talking and drinking and discussing, you know, writerly things and whatnot. And I said, oh, we should all do an anthology. And and I said, it should be about a bar. And
write what you know.
Exactly. And so, of course, everybody started talking about it. And so it ended up being a magical bar. And then it was a magical time travel bar. And, you know, Patricia Bray threw in, you know, the bartender should be Gilgamesh. That's how he found his immortality, was he found this bar. And so we ended up with this idea of this bar shifted through time, in the sense that at any moment in time, the bar was the like epitome of the best bar in the world at that time. And then as soon as came a little, you know, blasé, then the bar would magically shift to a new location and basically reshape itself into the epitome of the bar at that time. And so that was our concept. And everybody laughed and we all went home, and probably nobody else but me thought about it anymore. But I sat down and I said, we should actually do this. And so the next convention, which Montreal, the next convention I went to, I think it was World Fantasy in Montreal.
WorldCon was in Montreal in 2009.
Okay, that must have been it. WorldCon in Montreal.
I know, because I won an Aurora Award at that one. So
that's memorable for you.
Yes.
At the convention, I went to one of the guys that was part of Techno and asked them, you know, how you get an anthology pitched to DAW. Because Techno at the time was the one that was basically pitching anthology ideas to DAW. And so I asked him how it happened, and he said, you know, basically we just meet with and we pitch all of the anthology ideas we have. And then if there are any that they're interested in, that they, you know, pick those out, and then those are the ones we do. And I was like, oh, cool. I have this idea for an anthology, and I have a bunch of authors lined up for it already. And so I pitched the idea to him, and he said, well, write up write up the theme and who your authors are going to be. And we're meeting with Sheila tomorrow morning. And if you can get it to me tonight, we'll pitch it.
No pressure.
So I ran back to my hotel room and wrote up the idea and emailed a whole bunch of writers saying, you know, remember this idea we had? I said, are you willing to be an author for it? And so I ended up putting the pitch together, and they pitched it to DAW, said yes. And that was the anthology After Hours, Tales from the Urbar. And so, you know, we ended up, Patricia Bray and I ended up we edited it for DAW, and they put it out. And then the next year we did another pitch for the Modern Phase Guide to Surviving Humanity, and DAW put that out. And then there was a huge shakeup in the world, and DAW didn't quite drop their anthology line. They reduced their anthology line from, like, they were doing like 6 or 8 a year, and they reduced it down to like 1 or 2. So basically they were not anthologies at that point, because the 1 or 2 that they were doing were, you know, anthologies for like Mercedes Lackey and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So at the time, Patricia and I were kind of bummed, and we said, well, let's wait a couple years and see if Daw brings back the anthology line. So we waited a couple years, but I got impatient decided the anthology line was never coming back, and that if I wanted to edit more anthologies, I needed to do something about it myself. And so that was when I said, okay, let's see if we can create a crowdfunding was becoming a major thing at that time. And so I said, I can get the money through crowdfunding. And so I researched it and established the small press, and our first anthology, Clockwork Universe, and crowdfunded that. And that was the beginning. We started off doing one anthology a year, and then we switched to 1 year where we had two. And then I got ultra ambitious, I guess, and moved to three the year after that. And so now we're doing three anthologies a year. And so far, like I said, we've funded almost all of two that we kind of, that were kind of, I don't consider them our main anthologies. They were kind of sideline anthologies. And those two didn't fund. But our main anthologies have all funded. So yeah, we do that every year now, the pattern. Three new anthologies every year.
That's quite impressive. You get a lot of great authors. He says modestly, being one that's been in a couple of them. But you get a lot of great authors and great stories. So, and as I said, it certainly was one of the inspirations for when I did the Shapers of World anthology for my first year guests, and Shapers of Worlds Volume 2 then funded as well. So you were an inspiration to me, Joshua.
Well, I'm glad I could help with the Kickstarter stuff. It's not easy doing it from scratch.
No, I put it off for a long time because it just seems a little intimidating. But it worked, so there you go. Well, we're almost at the end of the hour, so I'll ask you my big philosophical questions now. The first one is, why do you write? Why do you write this stuff? Why do you write, I should say? Why do you think any of us write? Why do we do this strange thing with words where we tell stories? And then the third one is, why fantastical stories specifically? So there's your three philosophical questions.
Okay, well, I'll try to answer all three, but if I miss one, just remind me. The snarky answer is, you know, I write because the, voices in my head tell me to, but that's not quite true. The voices are there, yes, and like I said, with the Lay series, I didn't really get started on the Lay series until the character Kara showed up, and I wanted to tell her story, but it's not that they're insisting I tell their stories. It just started back in the eighth grade, where this all of a sudden arc of an idea that, you know, people actually wrote all of these stories, that spark just stuck. And I've always enjoyed, you know, putting words on paper and bringing these characters to life for other people. And that's why, you know, in college I made that decision. Do I really want to do this just for kicks? Is this just something for me? Or is this something seriously and try to get it out there in the world? And I made the decision that, you know, that there wasn't any complete satisfaction in just writing it for myself. You know, I wanted to share characters in these worlds with other people. So for me, it's an act of discovery, because I'm the pantser. So I sit down and I say, okay, let's let this talk. And so I get to enjoy, you know, discovering the character's world and living the character's life. And so that's fun. That's what gets me through the writing part of it. And then once that's done, I was never just satisfied with saying, okay, that's cool, I lived their world. I wanted to share the world. And characters. And hopefully, you know, the readers falling in love with the characters as much as I am when I'm writing them. And even though, you know, horrible things usually happen to the characters. So for me, the writing, it's living this alternative life and discovering this world outside of my own. You know, why do people write in general? I think it does boil down to that. I think you're putting a piece of yourself out there. You know, even though it's different characters and you're sharing a little bit of yourself with other people. And I think it's one of the great things about the sci-fi community is that in general, we are, you know, we are a community. We want to see what other people are doing, and we want to read these other worlds and find out more about these people and worlds. And it, so it is a very nice community, and I think it's all about just sharing. So that's why I think people write in. It's like you said earlier, it's basically a form of communication. As to why why I particularly like fantasy and science a little bit. I mean, I don't write a lot of science fiction, but I'm trending in that direction at the moment. I think it's easier to talk about things that are not necessarily set in our world. And they're not necessarily realistic. The fantasy and sci-fi world settings allow to sort of explore and comment on things in our own world without, you know, necessarily creating arguments. Like for the Lay series, if you're reading closely enough in the Lay series, you know, there's some pretty heavy duty commentary I'm trying to make about us abusing natural resources. Because in the novels, you know, the Lay is a natural resource and we're using it. And the problem is that we have not just started to use the Lay, we've started to abuse the Lay. And that's what creates a lot of the problems in the Lay series. And so there's, you know, there's some commentary about treating your natural resources with a little more respect in that series. And then in the series that I'm writing for DAW, there's some commentary. This is more social commentary in the respect of, you know, a lot of what's been happening in our world over the last, you know, year and a half. I didn't intentionally write about this. Like when I sat down, I wasn't like, I'm gonna, you know, get on my podium and speak about these things. But it crept into the book. And that's why I don't do revisions till the end, because I don't know necessarily what the book is really about mm-hmm. until I hit the end of the book. And so the science fiction and fantasy settings give me a way to kind of make some commentary about this without, like I said, without being on a podium and browbeating people with it or whatever. It's never, you know, soapboxes for anything like that. Any of these kind of social commentary things, it's always an underlayer of this. And you know, hopefully people are kind of picking up on it as they read. And hopefully whatever it is I write makes them think about it a little bit.
Well, I guess you've already answered the next question, which is, what are you working on next? Because you've mentioned several times there's a new trilogy coming.
Yes.
Does it have a title?
I don't. The series is called the Crystal Cities series. And it's new for me in the sense that I am not writing this trilogy in the same world as the other three. So it's a brand new world and a brand new setting and magic system kind of stuff. Obviously, the the magic system is based off of crystals. And I don't know yet whether it's going to be released under my name or under a pseudonym. Sheila had a chance to talk about it because it doesn't come out until next year. The first book, I think the first book is slated for August 2022. And the first book is called Crystal Lattice. And the second book is Crystal Rebel, and the third is Crystal War. And like I said, I just started book three in that series. And I'll be interested to see what people, because, you know, the lay series, it's a fantasy, but like I said, it has a much more modern feel to it. So there's some kind of science fictional elements to the lay series, but, you know, in the end, it's a fantasy. It was written like a fantasy, and it was always intended to be a fantasy. The new series, I'm pushing the science fictional elements a lot further than I did in the lay series. So it's still a fantasy. It's being written as a fantasy, but anybody is gonna notice the sci-fi elements to it, pretty much right off the bat. My current trend is leaning more and more heavily toward science fiction. So we'll have to see what happens after this series.
And where can people keep up with you online?
Okay, there is a webpage for me and for zombies. So my webpage is joshuapalmateer.com. The zombies webpage is zombiesneedbrains.com. And you can find us on Facebook. Zombies Need Brains on Facebook. And Joshua B. Palmateer on Facebook. We're on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Ben Tate Author. Obviously set up when the Well was coming out, because it was released under the pseudonym Ben Tate, Benjamin Tate. And then Zombies Twitter is ZNBLLC. And then we have a Patreon page. So if you want to help support the small press and maybe even me on the side, then just search for us on Patreon. We have a Patreon page there as well.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of the time. So thanks so much for being on, Joshua. It was great to talk to you. I hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, yes. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
And hopefully we will get to see each other in person again one of these conventions soon. That would be nice.
I'm planning on hitting Montreal, assuming the border is open.
Yeah, I'm theoretically going to be at Montreal, but that's still a bit up in the air, but I hope I'll be there. So maybe that's when we will meet in person again. But for now, we're virtual, and it was a great chat. So thanks very much.
Again, thank you.
Thanks again to Joshua for that great conversation. I really enjoyed that. I always like talking to my fellow DAW authors, but I like talking to all authors. just a reminder that The World Shapers is online at theworldshapers.com. It's also on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me online, as I'm sure you want to, at edwardwillett.com, 2 T's on Willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. And you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. I missed that memo about having the same handle on all social media. You can find Shadowpaw Press, which again will be publishing Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, close to 150,000 words of fiction, 18 new stories and 6 reprinted stories featuring authors from the second year of this podcast. That'll be coming out in October. Shadowpaw Press is at shadowpawpress.com. It's also on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press and on Facebook at Shadowpaw Press. We have many more great, well, there's no we, it's just me, unless you count the cat. I have many more great guests coming up. I recently talked to, Laurel K. Hamilton, for example. So keep coming back to The World Shapers and continue to check out the authors I have talked to. Just before I wrap up here, I need to remind you once again that the World Shapers podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexys. Savings, checkings, GIC, budget, RESP, RRSP, TFSA, mutual funds, credit score, emergency funds, variable versus fixed rates, compound interest, retirement. The list goes on and on. It's time to make sense of it all. At Kinexus Credit Union, they want to help. Financial literacy is a critical life skill, giving you the knowledge and confidence to make smart, responsible decisions about your money. Visit KinexusMoneyTalk.ca to find expert advice, tips, and solutions for all life stages and events, and increase your financial literacy knowledge and confidence today.
Alrighty, that takes care of the housekeeping necessities, and that takes care of this entire episode of the World Shapers podcast. Again, thanks to Joshua Palmateer for being my guest. Thanks to you for being my listeners. And I hope that you will continue to come back many times in the future as I continue to talk to the science fiction and fantasy authors who've created the worlds and characters and adventures that we've enjoyed so much over the years. That's it for this episode. Bye for now.